Welcome to Still Not Asking For It, a podcast brought to you by Hope Harbor, a sexual trauma recovery center. I'm your host, Elena, and Mel and I have on this episode, Mary Duke. Mary Duke is a Lamaze childbirth educator, the doula, and she's just like an overall amazing example of what an advocate is. And so she had reached out to us through Facebook to come on the show to talk about what birth trauma can look like and how birth and the processes with doctors and all the visits and stuff while being pregnant can affect a survivor of sexual trauma. This episode was super exciting for us. We're huge fans of Mary Duke. She's basically a social media guru. Please go ahead and follow her. Even if you're like me, who is a person who is not planning to have children, I still find her information just really cool, really exciting. And so we'll have information in the content of the episode for you to find the links to follow her, along with some of the other resources that she gives. Also, trigger warning that we will be talking about, you know, sexual trauma, as well as some of the traumatic things that can happen to people while giving birth, as well as invasive procedures prior to. But we hope you enjoyed the episode. So to get us started, why don't you just go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us about yourself, what you do, what you're into.
So I'm Mary Duke, and I am a Lamaze certified childbirth educator, and I'm also a birth doula. And I have been in the birth world for about a decade now, attending births, preparing families for births, birthing my own children. I have three kids, 6, 2, and just 4 months old. And I've experienced hospital and home birth myself. I've supported families in all different birth settings. And a big part of what I do is advocacy. I am an advocate for parents, for childbearing parents, to make sure that they know their rights, to make sure they have all of their options. I like to go and advocate at a state level to make sure that Kentucky has good birth options. I've gone and advocated at a national level, and most recently have been placed on the international board within Lamaze International. So that's really where my heart is just advocacy and taking care of parents through the childbearing year, through pregnancy, birth, and then especially on into postpartum.
You know, I wish I would have taken the time to think about this before we started recording, of like how long I have like followed you on social media and like known about you. I mean, it's been years for sure. Before I think my goddaughter was born, Iris, I think that's like when I started getting into like, yeah, birth stuff. I've never been pregnant. Don't plan to be, don't plan to ever have children myself, but I'm just like so into, yeah, like midwifery and doulas and, you know, this overall kind of like more like a holistic kind of approach.
And Elena, I love, like, you are my part of my favorite group of followers, because I love people who do not have children, have no plans of having children, but still have space for this in their life, because you love people who have children. You love people who will have children. And I think it's important that we all understand what parents go through and how we can support them. And so, yeah, I love people who are not parents, but follow me.
Yes. And I definitely want to promote for people to follow you on social media. My Sunshine Birth Services.
Yes.
Mary Duke, right? That's what it is.
Yeah. My Sunshine Birth Services, Mary Duke. If you're on Facebook and you just search Mary Duke LCCE, it'll pop up. And then on Instagram, My Sunshine Birth. And those are the two places that I'm most active.
Yeah. And you like are my social media like icon. You and Cree Dye, who, you know, we just recorded with, or our last episode will be with. And like, and again, you all are Bowling Green famous, which sounds kind of like, but like, I think it's a big deal.
Well, I appreciate being placed up there with Bree, and I do love social media. I really do. There have definitely been moments in my life, as with anything, where I have to step back, take a little break, and then jump back in. But I really love social media. I love the community that I've been able to build there. And the truth is that my entire career and business has been built off the back of social media. I mean, I've really used it a lot and I love doing it. So I appreciate you saying that.
And I love to point out to the benefits of social media, because it does often, right? Like, people often talk about all the negatives. And I'm glad that you pointed that out about community, because like the engagement that you get on your posts is like so impressive. As someone who does social media for Hope Harbor, I'm like, oh, how can I mean, and I really think it's the topic, right? And I think to our culture, where there's, you know, a lot of like mom shaming or just not the space for parents to discuss these things, you know, and you'll often have these, I mean, not necessarily like hot topics, but just like things that people can relate to and they've never been asked.
Right. Right. We're putting out, we're putting questions out there that all parents are thinking about, but nobody's really talking about. And I am an open book and I will share my own stuff. And that's really what leads people to feel safe to share. Because it's one thing for me to say, tell me about these things that are happening to you. But for me to say, this is happening to me also, it opens that up for everybody. I love hearing from people. What you see in engagement in the comments is one thing. What I get in my DMs is a whole nother thing. And, you know, just everybody feeling like they can have a place to feel not so alone. One of my most popular posts that I actually get requests for if I forget to do it is in the middle of the night, I will post for parents to say why they're not sleeping. That's it. Like, why are you not sleeping right now? And it could be anything from breastfeeding, pumping, all the way to taking care of a child who's had a nightmare or cleaning up a wet bed, or you're up because you're just worried about your kids and you just can't sleep because you're thinking about them. And so that's just it. That's just people feeling isolated in the middle of the night, wanting an opportunity to see I'm not alone. And all around the world, parents feel this way too, and they're not sleeping either.
I will say, from me being a parent and someone who follows you, it has also empowered me to say more things when I find out that someone is a new parent. Because that was something, my child is 4. So I remember like 5 years ago when I found out I was pregnant, just like the fear of like asking questions and how many people talked about things in these like poetic hypotheticals of everything's beautiful and da da da. And I was like, I really don't want to hear that. I need to hear all of the horror stories. Like, I need to hear all of the bad, also with the good. You know what I mean? Like, I want a realistic look at what's actually happening. And so I feel like you and other people like you have really empowered me to, I just found out a friend of mine, is pregnant. And so now I feel like, I'm like, what do you need? I got these books. This is what I went through. Here's my stories. What do you need? And so those are things that I feel like this parenthood thing of just acting like it's all perfect is kind of becoming a thing of the past. And I feel like people like you have kind of pushed that movement of like, no, let's really talk about what happens. Cause I do feel like that's kind of this like taboo topic sometimes. It's like talking about those, the scary, the dirty, the nasty details of what actually happens.
Yeah. And Mel, you make such a good point. I call those just realistic expectations. Like, whenever I'm talking to families, I'll tell them, well, this is the dream. This is what we're shooting for. But now I'm going to give you some realistic expectations. And that could be in the birth room. That could be when you get home postpartum. That could be when you're parenting a 4-year-old. We don't get a lot of that. And this whole, like, one of the things that I could do without ever seeing again is this thing that goes around Facebook, the meme that says, the dishes can wait, make memories with your child, blah, blah, blah. Somebody's got to do the dishes. Like, somebody's got to do the dishes. Somebody's got to do the laundry. Like, people have to be fed. Stuff has to be done. Like, you're taking a mom who feels so overwhelmed because she's not able to get these things done. She feels like she's being suffocated by the mess in her house. It is a real visceral reaction that she is having to clutter and to not being able to get through her list of things. And you're like, don't worry about it. Snuggle your baby. I could do without ever seeing that again.
It reminds me, I think this is one I recently saw where, and I feel like it had to have been on your page or someone shared it to you or something, where it was like, sleep when the baby sleeps, do laundry when the baby does laundry, yes. You know, yeah. Just like this ridiculous, yeah. You know, like, right. In which, and again, I guess, yeah, the negatives, right, of social media, but like, just not telling the full story.
Yes. And let me just say, if you're going to share or tell a mom to not worry about the dishes, you can't just say that. You have to show up and do her dishes for her. So, okay, don't worry about the dishes, snuggle your baby, but I'm going to bring you a warm meal and I'm going to do your dishes for you. Like, that's how we need to be handling these things.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I feel like the people that I remember, you know, in the hard times, well, even now that when he's four and I think about people helping out, but those are the people like when they're coming over, and I'll brag on my mother-in-law. She's one of these people that she's like, I remember doing it. And so like, she's showing up and like cleaning my house and doing these things, or just let me take the baby so you can have a nap. And things like that, that really mattered. And I'm like, please do not buy me another onesie. Just like, come help me.
Yes. Come help me. Send me some help. Yeah. I'm drowning.
Okay. So, also what makes me feel really cool, not only having you on, the show, Mary, also, I always just refer you as Mary Duke. Like,
please do. Everybody does.
It's double name. But is that you reached out to us and asked to come on, the show, which also just made me feel like I'm Bowling Green famous.
And we're Australia famous now.
We are actually. Oh, thank you for bringing that up.
You're going to be heard by people in Australia. We have magically gotten all these listeners in Australia.
Yeah. So we are like 71% of our listening base comes from Australia.
It's big in Australia.
Yeah. That's cool. Something interesting. Yeah. Like what the birth practice, cause I've heard, okay, we're going to get off onto a whole other thing, but yeah, like what birth practices are like and what's the norm in other countries as opposed to in the US. Cause I know like the US, the business of being born was like this movie that I don't even know why we watched it, since, you know, again, don't plan to ever have kids. And that just like, I'll never forget. I think that's like what started mine and Michelle's like being best friends, was when she's like, oh, I'm pregnant. And I was like, you know, I was like, oh, have you watched The Business of Being Born? And she's like, no. I was like, yeah. Like, are you into like, you know, all natural birth and stuff? And I swear that is like what sent her onto this. You know, she did have a home birth, like water birth. Like, it's like this, like most beautiful. There's a video. I just like tear up thinking about it.
Well, The Business of Being Born, it was a documentary by Ricky Lake, and it did. I mean, I'm sure there are thousands of people who have chosen a more natural approach to childbirth just because of that documentary. I know lots of people who have. It's really interesting. I mean, if anybody has the opportunity to watch it, it still holds up. I think it is about a decade old at this point, but yeah, it still holds up and it's a great documentary.
I mean, it made me want to have a natural at home, like water birth, which didn't end up happening. I had a bunch of complications. So that's another story, but it almost made me mourn that as well. And it made me come to a lot of realizations about limits, of like what Bowling Green has, because like once you go out of that home birth, where like, I guess larger cities or maybe more progressive cities have, birthing center options or like hospital. The hospitals are more, I don't know the word I'm looking for, adaptive with those things, equipped. So I remember when I realized I was going to have a hospital birth, like going to the hospital and like asking these questions, and the nurses were staring at me like,
Right. You're not in the right place for all of that.
Which is a lot of the advocacy work, though, that you do, you know, and that like your coalition does is to improve these.
The birth options. Yeah. So Kentucky Birth Coalition, we have worked really hard over the years to get licensed certified professional midwives. Kentucky now has those. That means that you can have a licensed state licensed professional at your home birth in Kentucky. And then the thing we're working on now is to try to get birth centers in Kentucky. There are people who want to open them. There's actually a set of midwives who have everything they need. They've got furniture in storage. They're like got the business plan. They want to do it, but they can't. Because there's some legislation that needs to happen so that they can. So we're working on that right now. But yeah, right now in Bowling Green, you have one hospital to choose from. You go there and no water birth, hydrotherapy, that's not an option. And it is very limiting.
Yeah. And even to the surrounding counties, like that there aren't other hospitals, like everyone has to just come in to Bowling Green. But yeah. Okay. So whenever you had messaged me and talked about wanting to come on, to the podcast, come on to Snappy, you know, you had talked about the experience that survivors of sexual assault and sexual trauma, you know, have whenever they, you know, they do become pregnant and then they go through birth, as well as the concept of, I think that you called it birth rape.
Some people do refer to it as birth rape. It's the simple, I mean, they just break it down to the fact that you have somebody putting their hand or other devices inside your vagina without your consent. Which if you break it down that way, that would be rape. So yeah, it can be thought of as birth rape.
Yeah. So I guess, let's talk about that. Like how it's triggering, how the process, right, is not always, trauma informed, how it's not always, you know, centered on that person's needs, which again, this is my education coming from Business of Being Born, where just the process become very medicalized.
Yes.
Rather than this like natural, you know, thing.
Yeah. So the reason that I reached out and wanted to come on the podcast is one, I really appreciate Hope Harbor and everything that you all do for our community. And I want to support you all and anything I can do with you all. But the other reason was I thought this would be the perfect opportunity to bring up a topic that very rarely gets spoken about in our area. And that is how victims of sexual abuse react to childbirth, how they're treated in childbirth, and how birthing may be different for them. And then on the other side of that, you know, you mentioned the birth rape part of it, but that's, some people refer to it as birth rape. Some people, it's obstetric violence is the term that I tend to go with. It's a little less triggering. So, obstetric violence, in birth, that can happen to anybody, whether or not you've had a history of sexual abuse. Specifically for people who have had childhood sexual abuse, they report that the birthing process can be really difficult for them. It can often feel like they've been put back into the situation. They can have a lot of the same sensations. The pain can be often the same. So they can just have feelings and emotions that kind of put them back in that abuse. So what happens is we have people who have experienced this abuse. And as you all know, how often are people even reporting it, talking about it? Not as much as it should be. So then they are silently often going through this experience of childbirth after abuse that we can't help them because they haven't even told us. So how can we get information to those people? How can we help them to have a better birth experience? What can we do for them is really, really what I want to make sure that we talk about today. The big thing is for them to build a birth team, around them that they feel safe talking to, and that is able to provide them the type of sensitive care that they need. And so this would be trauma-informed care. So you would want to make sure that you're picking a obstetrician, midwife, doula, someone who is trauma-informed. And they're going to maybe have additional training. Maybe they've just done their own research. Maybe it's from years of experience working with victims of sexual abuse. But they're going to have some kind of game plan for how they're going to help you through the situation. So that would be the big thing. Just first looking at who you're birthing with.
And, you know, and that choice, right? Like, is something that, and when choosing a doctor or any type of medical professional, people don't always, I think, recognize, right? I mean, well, one, two, sometimes there's not a whole lot of choice. Sometimes it's, I'm the only one that's available, you know, we've talked with that about, like, at the office, you know, with staff. And I will say, yeah, in Bowling Green too, talking about needing, you know, a gynecologist or an OBGYN, like, it's like, oh, good luck, you know, getting one in. And so I do think, but when it comes to a doula, you know, right, or these other, you know, types of support, that choice and having that trauma-informed education and stuff definitely seems more available.
Can you make a distinction, just in case others don't know this, the differences between what a obstetrician, a midwife, and a doula do?
Absolutely. So a doula does not provide any medical care. They are only there to provide emotional and physical support for the parents, and they are there to be an advocate for you. And then you have a midwife. A midwife is a maternity care provider. They can do anything that an OB can do except for surgery. There may be a few other things that may not be within their scope, but for the most part, they can't go into the OR. They wouldn't deal with high risk patients either. So a midwife would be dealing with, for the most part, just low risk, normal pregnancies. An OB, an obstetrician, that is somebody who is trained specifically for in-hospital high risk situations. They are also surgeons. So if you look at your own situation and you are a low risk, normal pregnancy, more than likely the best option for you is to be with a midwife. If you are somebody who's high risk, or you may need a cesarean, then obviously you'll need to be with an OB, and then anybody can have a doula for additional support. I would also specify that midwives can work in hospital or out of hospital. So they would also work in birth centers and at home. Most people don't know that a midwife is an option, and most people don't realize that a midwife is as capable when it comes to low risk, normal pregnancies.
Yeah. So thinking about, like, right, like the choices that, like, say a survivor, so maybe they know they're a survivor. They know about this. They know that birth could possibly cause trauma. Mm-hmm. Right. And that they're like, now they're like searching for this trauma-informed team. Right. I'm going to assume that is not what mostly happens. That what most commonly happens is, you know, everything seems fine. You know, that nothing seems wrong. They're pregnant, they're excited, they're growing their family. Mm-hmm. And then they go into these appointments, mm-hmm. and they're like, why is this traumatizing? Why is this bringing this back for me?
And here's the really tough part, Elena. A lot of times they're not even going to notice the issue until towards the end of pregnancy. And then they feel like it's too late to make any changes. The first procedure that may really bring home the fact that this isn't right, this doesn't feel right, is going to take place around 37, 38 weeks into your pregnancy. And that's your very first cervical exam. There's typically, in low risk situations, no reason to do a cervical exam until that point. So say everything's been fine, and now you're, you know, 2 to 6 weeks away from having your baby, and you experience this cervical exam and you don't know what to do. It's, you know, it can be really difficult to handle and know all your choices. And most people don't. You can always change providers. There's never a point that you can't. I have known a family to change providers, up until like they were like, somebody changed providers when they were in labor. That happened one time. We have had people change providers at 38, 39, 40 weeks. It's never too late. But as you can imagine, the average patient doesn't know that, and they feel stuck, and then they're just on the roller coaster. They're just going for the ride. But yeah, it's usually about that point. The cervical exams are the thing that are typically the most triggering for people.
Is cervical exam like when they say, I'm going to check you?
Yes, that's when they say they're going to check you. They're checking your cervix. Your cervix is located at the top of your vagina. And so they will take typically 2 fingers and insert them into the vagina to feel the cervix. They're trying to see if it's soft or hard, or what position it's in, or if it's opened or if it's closed, like what all's going on there. And I do need to take this moment to just say that there's not much evidence to show that cervical exams are necessary or give us very much information that we can use. It's often more, they say it's for timing. Like the doctor wants to know like how much longer you'll be pregnant, or if you're close, or your cervix isn't a crystal ball. It doesn't tell them anything. They don't know. So just, there's the first thing. Like if you are triggered by cervical exams, you don't have to have a cervical exam. And that gets us into a topic about rights. Like, what are my rights as a childbearing parent? And you can say no to any care. No, they cannot provide you care that you do not consent to. Okay. They'll bring up hospital policies. So it's important to understand that if a policy is put in place to protect you or your baby, your rights trump that at any time. So you can say no to any of those things. If there is a policy in place that is meant to protect the staff, the hospital staff, like anybody other than you, then you can't say no to that. So an example would be right now during COVID, they're only allowing in 1 support person and your doula. Well, you can't just march in there with your whole family and be like, screw you guys, I have rights. You can't do that because that policy is put in place to protect the nurses, you know, from not getting COVID. But if they come in and they say, we're going to check you, and you say no, and they say, well, it's our policy to check every 2 hours, you simply just say, well, I have a right to, well, you just say no. That's all you have to say. Like, right. So you just say no, and then they leave. They should leave. But what you need to understand is that you have a right to informed refusal at this point. So you're informed. They want to do this thing. This is why they want to do it. You want to refuse it. You refuse it. You're done. You don't have to do it anymore. And I have been with, people always ask me after I say that, they're like, well, have you ever actually been with families that don't have cervical exams? Yes, all the time, all the time. Birth does not rely on cervical exams. We don't need to know what's going on. It'll be okay.
I love your statement that the cervix is not a crystal ball.
I wish I could take credit for that. It's not mine. That's a saying that's been around for a long time, but I do love it very much.
And well, because, you know, thinking like there's just a lot of misconceptions on people's bodies, and, you know, and to tie it into kind of, you know, our work as, you know, slightly different advocates, but I've been in hospital rooms multiple times with survivors who are having the sexual assault forensic exam. Mm-hmm. Completed, where their body's treated like a crime scene. Yep. And I've had not only medical professionals, but also law enforcement, you know, be like ask the nurse, hey, will you let me know what you find? You know, and it's like, well, you know, because in my training, when I first was a volunteer at Hope Harbor, you know, that was one of the, I remember the first things that the volunteer coordinator at the time had told me, you know, was like, this kit is not, it's not like a pregnancy test, you know, where you pee on a stick and it says, yes, rape, no rape. There's not a way to look at someone's genitals and be like, wow, yes, definitely, you know, I mean, there are extreme cases, right? But, you know, but if there is any type of, you know, like evidence, it's just going to show that intercourse, you know, happened, you know, whether or not it was consensual is not something that your body is able to show, you know, and it's like, God, you know, for our society and specifically, I'd say the medical field to like not treat like vaginas and like vulvas very well, you know, historically and presently, but then to also think that there's all this like magic and like power.
Yeah.
You know, within it is like,
yeah.
So
yeah.
Confusing.
Yeah. It is this weird idea that somebody's going to come in and reach inside your vagina and then say, this baby will come in 6 hours and 20 minutes. We'll see you then. I mean, it's like, no, we don't know.
It's good to hear you say that too, because I feel like at least, and I should only speak from my experience, but I felt like because my body didn't do the things that a person who gives birth's body should do, or at least what I was told should do, it felt like a failure almost. Mm-hmm. And so like the point that at whatever weeks, so many people would like text me and be like, how far dilated are you? And like the fact that I wasn't was like, what, like, why is my body not doing what it should do? And it put me at this stress point with myself. And I'm sure so many people who are pregnant feel that way when it's like, the doctor told me, like, you should be at this and you're not. And it's just like, that's such a, okay, well, what am I doing wrong? You know, I'm trying to do all these things right. And I feel like there's so many people out there that probably feel that way of like, you know, I was told from a medical professional that I should be doing that, that it should be doing this and it's not. And there's not like a magical way to like make your cervix dilate in the correct timing of things.
Yeah. And what a valid feeling, Mel. I mean, so many people feel that and that they're spoken to that way. I mean, they really are. And a lot of people do feel like their body is failing them. That conversation just should be completely different. We should just be a little more hands off and we should say, you know what? I trust that your body is going to do what your body needs to do. And we need to definitely gear our conversations a little more that way. I do want to also point out though, that this conversation about saying no to cervical exams, it can oftentimes feel a little one-sided also. There are people who do want cervical exams. They do bring them comfort. They like to know what's happening. So it's really about your choice is what it comes down to. And I never want it to feel like I'm saying, if you chose cervical exams, you did it wrong. That's not the case at all. It's really just about you having the cervical exams that you want and saying no to the ones that you don't.
Yeah, I think that's what, I mean, a lot of, I guess the conversations that I have had, in the research and stuff that I have read about this connection between sexual trauma and birth and pregnancy is part of it is because some things are happening to your body without your control or in kind of, you know, what, you know, Mel had just shared, but then also, yeah, like your choice being taken away from you, you know, that like your body, just that disconnect sometimes between you and your body.
I think in general, like the concept of consent with medical procedures is something that isn't spoken about a lot. You know, we hear consent more so in like agreement in sexuality and sexual actions. But like that concept, I mean, just when we're in the hospitals with people and we're telling someone, especially someone who's not 18, and telling them like, you still have this consent on if you want this exam done and things like that. And they're shocked by that. They assume that they don't have that choice. And I would say there was times, you know, even though I felt informed, I feel that way sometimes in medical situations that, oh, this is just how it's done. You know, you don't have that choice. So just the concept of consent to medical procedures where, you know, so often you don't feel like you have any power in that situation to speak up and ask, you know, what you want and almost advocate for yourself. I just don't feel like that's talked about at all?
It's this environment where we're not supposed to question doctors, rooted in not questioning white men and anybody who has a white coat and all of these things. And there's a lot of, if you really dig into it, there's a lot of misogyny in that. But with that area being blurred, I think that it comes to also this whole idea of like shaming Google doctors, shaming people who want to research on their own, read the research on their own. They want to look into it themselves. I'm all about people having that opportunity to look into things, bring in the research that they've found and ask their questions. But no, we definitely have a society where those people are shamed and who do you think you are? And it shouldn't be that way. I do tell people to choose a doctor you trust. That's important. Like I want to have a doctor that I trust and I can say, you know what, in this situation, I do trust your knowledge and I trust what you're telling me here. And I'm going to choose to do what you're saying. That's always nice to have. We don't want to be in a situation where we're constantly battling someone we don't trust. We don't want to birth a baby with someone we don't trust. But yeah, you should be able to look up your own information and ask questions and have consent and refusal and all of those things. For me personally, something I need in childbirth is I need spontaneous labor because for me, that helps me to feel in control. My body chose this time. My body started when it wanted to, how it wanted to. And for myself, I really wanted to avoid any kind of induction of labor. And so because of that, I ended up carrying my babies much longer than other people do. And when I tell people how long I was pregnant for, the response I get is always, they let you do that? Like, they allowed you to do that? No, they didn't allow me. They didn't let me. I just told them that's how it was going to be. And the thing is that I chose care providers who knew how important that was to me and supported me in that. I did have an experience where a care provider did suggest and said, it is my medical opinion that you should have an induction at this point. And I, knew my rights to informed refusal and I didn't. And I, there's papers that have to be signed and things that have to be done. But in the end, you can make your own choices. And that is, Mel, you're absolutely right. People don't know that. And that's key. And I think why that's so important to your all's audience is that when you're dealing with someone who has experienced this ultimate loss of control of their body, and then to be put into this childbirthing experience, the key to feeling in control is knowing those rights and having that consent and refusal and knowing how to do that. Is it easy? No, it's not easy. I highly suggest having a doula if you're going to be in a hospital situation, and not just any doula, but finding a doula who does have experience with advocacy and somebody who's going to speak up. And, there's two different lanes that doulas kind of fall into. There are doulas who say, hey, I'm just here to physically and emotionally support you, and I'm not going to come between you and your doctor. And then there are doulas who say, no, my role is as an advocate, and I will advocate for you. So I think that it's really important to make sure you're picking a doula that's an advocate, somebody who's going to help you and speak up for you. It's not about picking fights. I've been doing this. I've been in the labor room for a long time, and I've never been in a fight or an argument with care providers. It's just having that person that has the confidence in the room to say, okay, just time out. Hang on just a second. I believe the parent has some questions. I don't think that they're comfortable with this. Let's have a conversation. And that's really all that it takes.
I have a question. I guess this would be in a hospital setting only, but does a person have choices? I'm thinking about from like a survivor's perspective, and just, do you have choices about how many people are in your room? And I mean like medical professionals, because I feel like that was something that was slightly jarring for me in my own experience, was like, I mean, you're pretty much naked in front of the entire world, it feels like. And I feel like it was, for me, it wasn't so much of a thing, but I feel like from a survivor's perspective or anyone who's gone through significant trauma, especially like bodily trauma, that was something that I feel like could be very jarring. But I feel like that would be something that, you know, are you allowed to ask, like, can less people be any? I just feel like there was a consistent stream of different people doing different things.
There's so many people in and out of the room in a hospital, and it is a ridiculous amount of people. I try to prepare, again, like realistic expectations. I try to prepare my families who are choosing to birth in a hospital with like, okay, this is what it's going to be like when you get there. This person's going to come in to do this, and there'll be this person. But the big moment is that when you're ready to deliver your baby, you can have in the room. So you have the parent, their support person, the doula, say if they have hired a doula, then you have the care provider. So the main care provider, the obstetrician or midwife, they have an assistant that is a technician that's there to help them. You have a labor and delivery nurse. You have a, and then you have a nursery nurse. So you have nursery staff there. So you have all of these people in the room, and your bottom is naked up in the air, and you're trying to push your baby out, and everybody's standing around watching. Yeah, that can be tough for anybody, but definitely for someone who's a survivor of sexual abuse. That's something that you have to talk to your care provider about ahead of time. I have in situations been able to get it down to where it is just the parents, me, one nurse and doctor. And that's the smallest we've been able to get it down to. And I've had situations where the doctor has been willing to kind of step out and walk away if mom's having an extended pushing period. So like, for those who don't have birth experience, a first-time mom can take, you know, 3 hours to push her first baby out. And so if she is pushing, but we don't see baby, she's just still working on moving baby down through her pelvis. The doctor's not really needed to be there. And so, you know, I've had a doctor step out. So yeah, you can get that number down. That does take some forethought. It takes talking about it in your prenatals, and it depends on the doctor. If they may be pretty adamant that they want to have their technician there to help them. But as far as the nursery staff goes, the nursery staff is there in case the baby needs resuscitation. They can wait in the hall. And that's something that we've often had to say, like, we appreciate you here in case of emergency. Could you just step out in the hall? And we've had them do that, to just not be standing there staring at the mom, you know? Yeah. So that is important. That's something you can think about too.
When talking about like choosing your team, your maternity care providers, I think, is that like the broad
birth team?
You know, when talking about like trauma-informed care, which I think is a pretty standard kind of, you know, across multiple fields, but like, I don't often see that like tacked on to people's like profiles, you know, or things like that. So like in your experience when finding, you know, whether they be obstetricians or midwives or doulas, you know, like, do you see these labels, or do you find that it's built through conversation? You find this out through conversation.
It's built through conversation. And honestly, there's not enough resources on this topic. There's not enough care providers who are trauma-informed, who are dealing with this. And honestly, the research and the resources are very lacking in general. The studies on it, I mean, there's just not a whole lot. I wish there was more. I wish more people talked about it. Home birth midwives, birth center midwives tend to be more trauma-informed than obstetricians. But yeah, it's something that you have to ask them about, and you can tell by their reaction. Like if you just say, I mean, you ask them, you know, do you have experience working with, survivors of sexual abuse? Do you feel like you're trauma informed? And it's pretty easy to tell by how they respond to it. You know, really where they're at on that.
Yeah, I think that's pretty standard for, and in a lot of different, yeah, like with a lot of different fields and a lot of different, yeah, to try to figure out, right, if somebody knows what you mean, first off, right, you know,
right, yeah.
In that way. But so in thinking too about like things that happen to your body, like without your consent during birth, one of the first things I think that I had learned about was episiotomy. Is that how you say it?
Episiotomy, yeah.
You know, and in hearing that that's not always a conversation that is had before that happens.
With the episiotomies, yeah, it's kind of amazing that we're looking at a procedure where they cut the perineum. The perineum is the space between the vagina and the anus. Most people know it as the taint. Like I've learned in class to like, I'm like the perineum and like all the dads are staring at me like, what? And I'm like, the taint, guys. They're like, oh yes. Okay. All right. That space. So that, but anyway, that's where they're cutting. And the fact that not only are people not consenting to this, but they're not even being told it's happening. Not even being told, Elena, like not even being told. It's crazy to me. So anymore, you will not see as high an episiotomy rate as you used to. It did become routine. There was a point where everybody got an episiotomy, where, you know, whether it was needed or not. But now that number is going down. More people are aware of it. They're talking about it. But yeah, talk about being out of control of your body. Talk about something being triggering. That, you know, even if you have an epidural and you're not aware it's happening, you'll find out that it happened. And then you'll have to deal with the fact that that happened to you without your consent, without your knowledge. And now you're dealing with healing from it. If you have an episiotomy, it can also cause you to tear into these like fourth degree tears where people often have to have reconstructive surgery. And then if you're you know, you've been through sexual abuse and now you've gone through this with childbirth and now you have to have more people down there and you're dealing with reconstruction and yeah, it can really get out of hand. So for everybody to just be aware, like episiotomies are not needed routinely. They should only be done in extreme cases for emergencies. And you need to have a conversation before you're in the delivery room with your doctor about when and why they would do one and make sure that you say to them, I do not want you to perform an episiotomy until you have my explicit consent. Like, I need you to talk to me about this, myself or my partner, but I need you to talk to me about this. Yeah, that's a really great point. It's something that it's a conversation that needs to take place. These conversations come up when we create birth plans. Birth plans have often gotten a bad name because the response is, well, you can't plan birth. You know, we don't know how birth's going to go. But what the reason we do birth plans is so that you can take that birth plan in before you're in labor, sit down with your care provider, go line for line through it, and it brings up these conversations. And so that way we are dealing with the, you know, figuring out where the doctor stands, what the parents want, what's going on before you're in the midst of labor. You know, have those conversations when you have your pants on. You don't have important conversations with no pants on. Doesn't make any sense.
That's another, did you come up with that one?
I wish that I did. No, probably not. I would like to say I did, but probably not. No, it was somebody else.
Yeah. But no, and I think too, that's a good point about the birth plan, you know, because that's a step to be trauma informed too, right? It's like knowing what to expect. Even if what to expect is that there are things that could happen that are unexpected, but let's go ahead and make a plan for if that happens.
Let's talk about it.
You know, because that's like a huge part of being trauma informed is one, being informed of what to expect, because that's usually what is very, because trauma is unexpected. I learned this in my trauma informed yoga training is, yeah, that trauma is unexpected. And so when anything else happens that is unexpected, like that can cause a trauma response, you know, can cause someone to be triggered in that way. Final thoughts. What were the, like, if there was something that we didn't touch on that you did want to mention, other resources for folks?
Something that I wanted to ask you about, and if you don't have an answer to this, you can cut it out. But I wanted to ask you, for people who are looking at, like, they're pregnant, they're survivors of sexual abuse, and they're getting ready to go through this experience, are there services that or resources within Hope Harbor that you would recommend for those people? But then also, say somebody wasn't a survivor of sexual abuse, but then they went through birth, and during that experience, they experienced obstetrical violence. Would there be resources within Hope Harbor for those people as well?
So I will say, I did ask one of our therapists specific, or one of our counselors specifically about this, you know, and she kind of responded, well, of course, you know, they could come to counseling, we, you know, with that trauma. But I will say, it is not conversation. If our clinical department is super knowledgeable about this, they have not let all of us know. And I will say, we've not been shy about, Mel and I have not been shy about this, that we use this podcast to educate our staff as well. You know, that, you know, I think that it's definitely something that I'm sure has come up, yeah. Right? But it's not something we explicitly advertise for. And I think especially for that second part of your question of, would this be considered a type of sexual violence in, you know, for our services? I would say yes. Right. But I could see that being, you know, a time where someone's like, let me go ask, you know, because we do have to follow, right, these specific, you know, grant kind of guideline types of things. But I mean, I think that we would, right, once having knowledge about it, being like, oh, wow, yeah, like that is something that makes sense. That makes sense that this is, you know, almost sexual in nature because of genitals, you know, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
It does make me want to get together a list of some sort. I almost feel like we should have resources that we could already at least say, maybe for like the Bowling Green area, of like, we know these providers or whatever, like, are informed. It makes me want to like call around and start asking questions for people, so that like, if we do have someone that's using our services and they tell us that they're pregnant, we can be like, oh, well, here's some, I don't know who your, you know, doctor is. I don't know, you know, if you're already seeing this person, but here are some OB options. Here are some midwife options, you know, that may be helpful. I feel like that's something that we could have that would be a good resource that honestly had never like come to mind before, but we have those type of resources in other ways, you know, and maybe having that like list to give to people, I feel like could be a good option that we need to look into and better our services.
And the other thing I was thinking before this interview about what resources I could provide for people to look into this, to get more information. Birth Monopoly is a really great place to go to for information. And actually, I think now that I'm saying it, Kristen Pescucci of Birth Monopoly, I think she probably came up with the don't have good conversations with your pants off thing. That was probably her. But Birth Monopoly is good. Mandy Birth Nurse, she's on Instagram. She talks a lot about trauma-informed care. She would be a good follow. And then book-wise, Penny Simkin wrote a book called When Survivors Give Birth. It is a good book. Everybody should check it out. I do wish that somebody else would write a book on this, though, just because it feels like one, you know, white cisgendered woman wrote a book on the topic 30 years ago and nobody else ever had anything to say about it. And then in looking at studies, there's very few studies that have been done on this. And when there have been studies done on it, all of the families that have been involved in the studies have all been white and in heterosexual partnerships. So there's definitely a lot missing. There's a huge part of this conversation that hasn't even happened yet. And there's not a lot of really fantastic resources on this. I even went on to a large Facebook doula group and I was like, hey guys, what am I missing? Where are these resources? And they were like, no, they're not really there. So it's really just at this point, it's about when you're interviewing care providers and doulas to make sure that you're asking them about their experience and their particular training and how they feel about these situations and what they would do for you in situations where you are losing control and how that would look. And being very careful about where you choose to birth, who you choose to birth with, just being aware of your rights, and those types of things. But unfortunately, there's just not a plethora of resources out there.
Thank you so much, Mary Duke, for this. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we're doing this podcast too, right? Is that there's not a lot. I mean, we're talking about sexual assault in general, you know, and especially when you get into these more specific sectors. But thank you so much for reaching out to us. Thank you so much for taking time, for making space in your schedule. It really does mean a lot.
Thank you so much for hanging out with us today. And remember, we're still not asking for it.
This podcast has been brought to you by Hope Harbor, a sexual trauma recovery center located in South Central Kentucky. Special thanks to Girl Tones for our intro. Listen to the rest of their song, Can't Pause, and others wherever you stream or buy music.